follow-up case of Halpern versus Wake Forest University Health Services. And whenever you're ready, take your time, but whenever you're ready, Ms. Grafstein, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court. My name is Lisa Grafstein of the North Carolina Bar, and I represent Ron Halpern, the appellant in this matter. Excuse me. If Ron Halpern's disabilities were physical and visible, I don't believe we would be here today. While there are prejudices against individuals with physical disabilities, stereotypes about individuals with psychiatric and other invisible disabilities tend to be more pernicious. And that's because it's harder for us sometimes to even recognize them when they surface.
They do affect performance differently, too.
Certainly. And such stereotypes have emerged in this case in the statements of Dean William Applegate, who was the dean of the medical school who dismissed Mr. Halpern from the school. Dean Applegate explained his decision this way. As I was considering Ron's letters and request that he not be dismissed, I did not think it was logical that the School of Medicine graduate someone who said he would need counseling, continue to need counseling for years in order to try to overcome or manage his behaviors that were inappropriate to the practice of medicine. Dean Applegate also said, I did not trust him to be able to make lasting change in his behaviors. Dean Applegate's statements are overt discrimination because they rely on the equation of disability-related behaviors with personal or character flaws.
He articulated some matters that clearly affect patient care. I mean, and had in Mr. Halpern's experience there clearly affected potential health care, not being able to appear and show up and being late and this type of thing.
Right.
I guess what you probably have to demonstrate is that they weren't genuine, that those weren't the real reasons. Because if they were the real reasons, it sounds to me like he may be justified in using those reasons if they were genuine reasons not to have him go further, because he does, at least in Applegate's opinion, did pose a risk for treatment to patients, and which is a pretty serious concern. And he seemed to be somewhat sympathetic to Mr. Halpern. But I suppose your argument has to be that it was a sham or it was a cover-up for something else. Is that right? Or
my argument really comes back to the issue of the stereotypes, that the way that Mr. Halpern's disabilities were viewed were stereotyped in the sense that there was a failure to separate the individual from the disabilities and the disability-caused behavior. And the way
he had a pretty long experience there. He had a long list of incidents on which he relied, and it's hard to think that he was stereotyping him when he said that. I thought he was making that based on his review of the record.
Well, and it's interesting. Dean Applegate actually did not know Mr. Halpern personally. He was reviewing the record, right? And to go to your point about the list of incidents, if you review Dean Applegate's affidavit around the pages of J-145, the incidents that he goes through primarily are focused on the period before Mr. Halpern's disabilities, the issues related to patient care, the more substantial and serious allegations that were made predated the time that Mr. Halpern took a medical leave to get his medication situation resolved. And I think what the...
there was some conduct after. Too. They recognized that there was a distinction, and they made a judgment call, and they said that some of the failures that existed before also occurred after.
There was a qualitative and quantitative difference. There was a period leading up into the medical leave at the end of 2006 that went into 2007, and then you have, I think, two or three different instances that were raised over the course of the next couple of years, which were the failure to write the thank you notes in a timely manner, and the incident with the dean's office. But
Side point, it's probably not material. Did he ever write those thank you notes?
He did, and I think this is addressed in the brief. He did, and actually what had happened was that he had gotten the information. Financial aid office said, you can just go ahead and email them, and he did that later the same day, but in the meantime, it had already been canceled. So he was out of town at interviews and so on, and so it fell through the cracks. There's no question about that. He clearly should have gotten them out, but he didn't. But obviously not the kind of incident that's referred to with regard to the earlier issues that where his medication was not controlled in the way it should have been, and the behaviors were clearly different than simply failing to get thank you notes out on time. So
I think they thought of that as symptomatic. That one, as you point out, substantively pose a risk to anybody.
Sure.
But I think they took that as symptomatic of his failure to get himself keep himself organized and address responsibilities.
Sure, and I think your point is important that there was nothing that was raised after his medical leave related in any way to any kind of danger or fear of for patient care. And in fact, if you look at that period of time over the 2 years leading up to his dismissal, he was engaged in not only remediating his internal medicine rotation, but I believe 9 or 10 other rotations where he was in fact specifically graded in the area of professionalism, and comments were indicating in his evaluation that he demonstrated professional demeanor, worked well in the healthcare team setting, pleasant and dedicated student, clearly 180 degrees from where he was prior to his leave, that he had remediated a lot of his issues.
But he slipped back. And would you like this guy operating on you?
Well, Your Honor, I think the issue is how the university viewed whether Mr. Halpern prospectively could demonstrate professionalism in the future. And to be quite frank, the issue regarding that we're at the end of his career, the issue regarding the thank you notes and the issue regarding his interactions with the dean's office, I don't think relate at all to the core issues that the medical school was talking about in terms of their concerns about someone operating on someone or being a doctor going forward. These were not situations that obviously were good situations, but they didn't go to the core of what it meant to train a doctor or to be a doctor. And that's why I think if you look at the overarching.
It was difficult to read this extensive record and exactly know the timeline. So what right. time, where do you think there's the break?
Thank
and
you.
What date do you put it at?
Right. Mr. Halpern went on medical leave in September of 2006. That was right at the end of his internal medicine rotation.
Right.
He came back in April, I think it was February, he came back of 2007 and did sort of a research project and went back into rotations in around April of 2007.
Right.
Okay. The dismissal, the issue regarding the thank you notes was...
The fall of 2007 was the new period? Begins the new period? That's what I'm trying to get at,
Right.
date.
And then the way they do the rotations is sort of unclear.
Your argument is that all of the things that went to his, as I understood what you were saying, to his professional abilities took place before he has his medication under control.
Exactly.
Okay, so when does the next period begin where he has his medication under control?
Right. That begins when he comes back from the medical leave in early 2007.
February 2007.
Right, February 2007. And the dismissal... process began.
Well, in spring 2007, he's put on probation.
Correct. And the specific reason is because he failed his internal medicine rotation, not because of any prior conduct issues. And the issues that were raised with him when he was put on probation, he was told he shouldn't fail any more courses or else he'd be up for review. There was no discussion about...
Well, doesn't that go to his ability to be a doctor? Failing his rotation?
It does, and he remediated that rotation afterwards.
I know, but I'm just going to, following up on Judge Motz's question, which is post-break conduct still raised questions, legitimate questions for the faculty there.
Right. He failed the rotation in 2006. There was a year and a half between the time he came back, more than that. He came back in February 2007, and he was ultimately dismissed in March of 2009. So he was actually back for 2 years prior to his dismissal. It was in November.
You're saying that from February 2007 till 2009, he was incident-free with respect to medical professionalism?
That's correct. The incident.
When did he tell the university that he had a disability?
As early as March 2006, Dr. Ernest's deposition, I think, or one of the documents indicates that he was aware that Mr. Halpern had sleep issues. And Mr.
Didn't your client testify either in deposition or was it in deposition that he wasn't telling people? Maybe I'm
confused. Yes, and I'll walk through that because I think that's important too. He was concerned even at the beginning of medical school about the stigma associated with learning disabilities.
It's singing in the gang, but if you don't tell,
right,
you don't get the benefit.
Right, there's two things about that. One is Dean Applegate, prior to the dismissal, was well aware of all the medical issues, the ADHD,
yeah,
and the.
Now we're jumping ahead.
Sure, but the relevant decision is the dismissal, and that's the relevant time frame.
Sure,
for that.
But you've been making a distinction between the time when he, according to you, got his medications under control. During that whole period, he told the university that he was disabled.
He revealed to Dean Ernest that he was having insomnia, that he was seeing a psychiatrist. He provided notes regarding his inability to take a certain board exam during a period, so they knew that he was under the care of a psychiatrist. I think it was September of 2006, there was a meeting between Dr. Ernest and Dean Latham Sadler. And
his disability was ADHD. Am I wrong?
His disability is ADHD. The insomnia resulted from he was taking Adderall for the ADHD and Ambien to sleep, and that's.
I have insomnia too, and I wouldn't get much break from these guys.
No doubt,
you have to agree with me, right? Insomnia. I mean, he's younger, to be sure, so he shouldn't have insomnia. But I've misread this record, but I thought there was a period when he was not, perhaps because he didn't want to be stigmatized, sure, telling anyone about his. Calling this a disability.
That's true. And then when he went on his medical leave, he at that point revealed, obviously, that it was a medical condition that was an overall problem for him.
He didn't tell him then, though, either, did he?
No, he did not reveal the specific.
Just medicines.
He did not reveal the specific diagnosis.
When did he give the specific diagnosis? He gave it to Ernest?
That's right. And the specific diagnosis of ADHD was in December 2007, and that was around a request for a testing accommodation. And I think this goes to the issue of what a person with a disability has to reveal and when they have to reveal it. The request for accommodation obviously triggers an obligation to say, this is my disability and here's medical information to support it. Until Mr. Halpern needed an accommodation, there was really no burden on him to reveal his disability. But
the conduct existed and the employer knows about it. I mean, you're right, there's no obligation, but he has that history.
Right, and I'm actually glad that you said the employer knows about it, because I think we need to distinguish those two contexts as well.
The employer knows about its conduct.
Right.
The employer doesn't know about the disability.
Right. So if we fast forward now to when he's appealing to Dean Applegate to keep him in school and let him remediate over time, he reveals his disabilities at that time. And what he was asking for was sort of prospective accommodations. And what Dean Applegate said in terms of why he could not be accommodated and would never be able to be a doctor or meet the standards of professionalism was that he didn't think that in the future Mr. Halpern would be able to reach those standards. So I want to make a distinction between the employment
context. Isn't that a medic judgment and not discriminatory judgment? In other words, it sounds to me that he was getting counseling. He told him about some counseling that was helping him or trying to help him. But I'm looking at this list, and even after he came back in February of 2007, here we have an April odd behavior, October failure to show up for exams at assigned times, failure to respond to calls about review of Dean's letter, rude and demanding. These are all different incidents that continue on after he came back.
Well,
and the point is, this is repetitive. And he had counseling, and he had medicine, and he presumably was adjusted. Now Applegate is making a judgment call. In view of this conduct, what kind of risk are we doing when we graduate a man in surgery? And he wanted to be a surgeon. He loved it. He had a passion for it. But it may be that he should get his PhD or do research. He obviously has some talent when he can get going. Probably plenty smart, but Your argument is that when Applegate's looking at this record, he's discriminating against him because of a disability and not making a genuine call about his ability to be a doctor.
The discrimination was the idea that prospective there wasn't a way for him to reach that standard. And Dean Applegate may have been making a medical decision. I don't frankly know what his particular area of focus is, but there was medical information from Mr. Halpern's psychiatrist. Dean Reifler, who was the associate dean for student affairs at that time, recommended an outside assessment to come in and bring that expertise to the table to say, is this somebody who can be relied on in the future to comply under proper care? The discrimination is relying on the stereotypes regarding whether this was a character flaw to him, whether he just
what
simply refused to change.
Could there be, if he is already receiving counseling, what change did he demonstrate that he could eliminate the problems that had existed up to that time? Because by the time we get to the 2009, presumably he'd gotten all his medicines adjusted, and presumably he was having counseling that should have taken care of some of these problems, yet nothing seemed to eliminate the risks that they were, the medical risks that they were concerned about.
Right, and he had engaged this treatment team to address those risks, and what they had determined was that there was, he did sort of have a more self-reflective attitude and have a better handle on his own limitations and his ability to recognize his anxiety, because a lot of this is around the anxiety disorder issue, and the ability and the willingness and the passion to work on changing to make sure that he could meet those standards. And the Dr. Hughes, who was the leader of that treatment team, and I've got my red button on. I hope I
can. Yeah, why don't you just wind up? You
right.
do have some.
Right.
Go ahead and finish your
Thank you.
Sentence, but yeah. you do have some rebuttal.
Dr. Hughes, who was the leader of his treatment team, in fact. Updated during the process, during the period of time when Dean Applegate had the matter under consideration, she updated that and gave a progress report that he was, in fact, making progress on the treatment plan that had been put in place by the medical professionals who were designed to address this.
Thank you. We'll talk to you some more.
Thank you.
Ms. Cox?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jill Cox, and I'm an attorney with Kilpatrick Townsend in Stockton and here representing the appellee, Wake Forest University Health Sciences. And I'll refer to the appellee as the medical school. It is true that at the time Mr. Halpern was dismissed and had gone through the appeals process all the way to the dean of the medical school, his treating psychiatrist at that time, Dr. Hughes, did submit a report with a progress plan and a treatment plan for Mr. Halpern going forward. However, at that time, in writing, Dr. Hughes, his treating psychiatrist, indicated that this was just the beginning of a long process of change that would be continuing indefinitely into the future. She offered no prognosis for the time frame of that change or for the likelihood of that change being effective. And the same is true even of Mr. Halpern's expert witness, Dr. Carr, who is engaged in this case. He testified when asked about the likely outcome of the progress plan that had been laid out by Mr. Halpern and his treatment team. He replied that he didn't know the likely outcome of that, and in fact had never referred a medical student to a treatment program such as that for help with disruptive behaviors such as the ones that Mr. Halpern had been exhibiting throughout the entire period of time that he was enrolled in medical school. At that point, the medical school had 4 years of information about Mr. Halpern's performance. It had 4 years of Mr. Halpern being repeatedly counseled by deans and faculty members and even put on probation due to his failure of an internal medicine rotation, which was in large part due to his unprofessional behavior.
Well, your colleague makes the point that there is a break and that after he got his medications under control, that he didn't seem to have academic problems. And you think the university was entitled to take into effect the prior period before there was the remedy of his medications?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The university was entitled to take into account his entire history of performance at the medical school. even assuming, and I think the link that's been made here is very tenuous, but even assuming that Mr. Halpern's conduct that got him into trouble with the professionalism standards was related to his disabilities, solely to his disabilities, even assuming that, the medical school was not required to fundamentally alter the nature of its program by lowering its professionalism standards or even by excusing him from his unprofessional behavior during the first 2 years of medical school. That would not be a reasonable accommodation. It would be required either by the Rehabilitation Act or the ADA. And I also disagree with respectfully with my colleague's interpretation of the record with regard to the performance issues. I understand that Mr. Halpern maintains that there was a break in the February 2000 timeframe when he returned from medical leave. The record demonstrates that on February 19, 2007, Mr. Halpern assured Dr. Ernest and the SPPC, the faculty committee that reviews professionalism and academic performance, that his sleep issues, which he claimed, along with his grandmother's illness, had resulted in those professionalism problems, had been completely resolved. And as Judge Niemeyer pointed out, in April 2007, there was a noted incident of odd behavior in the financial aid office, which made staff members nervous. He missed a required lecture in his neurology rotation in April 2007. He missed a scheduled family medicine exam and failed to respond to medical school pages in October 2007. And at that point, the dean of the medical school even recommended giving him a zero, a failing grade on the exam. The faculty member decided to give him a break. None of these things are things which would evidence a stereotype or a bias. He was given repeated accommodations and breaks throughout his time in medical school. Then in January 07 through February 08, he participated in
medical school that he had a disability.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
When did he notify the medical school that he had a disability?
In December 2007, Mr. Halpern.
So the things that were done prior to that time, can they be counted as being in response to a disability?
Your Honor, you're correct on that. The things done prior to that time cannot fairly be counted as being in response to a disability, but they were very accommodating to him when he indicated he had an unspecified medical situation. Even when he did not disclose the nature of his underlying medical problems, he just simply submitted a note from his doctor that granted him a medical leave of absence.
It probably has no legal consequence, but it might have some consequence in the attitude and approach school took with respect to him, which was fairly accommodating in the common sense word of it. He basically got to take every exam. He didn't have to flunk a single exam because of his failures to show up or not. He got to make up things that he was told not to do, but they still showed concerns about his ability to be a doctor, I guess.
That's correct, Your Honor. And even after he notified the medical school of the nature of his disability, he continued to have ongoing incidents and was given essentially a break. In the February 2008 timeframe, he underwent the OBGYN rotation, and he had noted problems on the evaluation of that clinical rotation regarding his ability to accept constructive criticism and to accept feedback graciously. He was told that he needed to realize that the rules applied to both to him as well as everyone else. And then, of course, we've got the incidents at the end of October 2008 that led to the SPPC review of his entire student record. And those incidents included the failure to send thank you notes, even despite repeated reminders from the staff. Rude and belligerent behavior with the staff in the dean's office in connection with the preparation of his dean's letter. These are not conduct issues which are disputed in the record. Mr. Halpern has not denied that he engaged in this conduct, and he's also not attempted to attribute this more recent conduct in the late 2008 time period to his claimed disability. He said he simply forgot to send the letters. He has attempted to distinguish the February 2000 time period professionalism issues with the professionalism issues that arose later, and tried to say that the ones that arose later do not indicate potential patient care problems. But I would respectfully submit that the affidavit of Dr. Applegate very clearly and substantively demonstrates otherwise. Dr. Applegate went to great length in his affidavit to explain why these incidents of professional misconduct or unprofessional behavior gave him grave concerns and, in fact, made him terrified to permit Mr. Halpern to graduate and become a physician.
Was Dr. Applegate deposed?
Your Honor, I do not believe Dr. Applegate was deposed. Well, yes, Your Honor, he was deposed. Forgive me.
So if there was contrary admissions that could be gotten from him, they were gotten, right?
That would have been the opportunity, Your Honor, and I would submit that to my knowledge there are no contrary testimony included in his deposition. Nothing that would contradict his affidavit.
I was interested in the deposition of the plaintiff, Mr. Halpern, because it seemed to me that some of the things he concedes were, some of the things that he was chastised for, he concedes were not the result, as I remember it, of the disability. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. He concedes that the failure to send the thank you notes, he didn't know if that was the result of a disability, and he said he simply just forgot.
And doesn't he say that I'm sometimes just abrupt or something? Am I misremembering the deposition?
No, Your Honor, you're remembering that absolutely correctly. He did explain that he sometimes had an abrupt manner or just a direct manner, and he even his own physician attributed some of the conduct issues to his cultural upbringing and his way of communicating. So he did attribute many of the conduct issues not only to his claimed disability, but also to personality traits, his upbringing in Israel, where he contends people are more direct than they are here in southeastern United States, and that he might be perceived as being rude, even if that was not his intention. So even Mr. Halpern and Dr. Hughes, his treating physician who submitted letters of support in connection with his appeal of the dismissal recommendation, concede that his dismissal or the conclusion that he should be dismissed based on unprofessional conduct was not solely because of his disability. And that's the standard that we're dealing with here under his claim under the Rehabilitation Act, not the motivated by disability standard, which would be the standard under the NADA claim, which was not pled in a complaint, but which the appellant has argued as though it was pled. I also would state that even if some, or even for argument's sake, all of Mr. Halpern's unprofessional conduct throughout his entire career at the medical school was solely due to his disability, the medical school, under the established case law, still would have the right to make decisions about his qualifications to graduate based on the conduct and his failure to meet professionalism standards. The case law and the statutes make clear that the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act do not require an institution to excuse a student from meeting its required standards of whether that be professionalism standards or academic standards.
Was your handling of Mr. Halpern consistent with the way that you have dealt with other problem students? Anything inconsistent with the way the university handled?
Your Honor, there is nothing in the record indicating either way, frankly, but I will say that there's certainly nothing in the record advanced by the appellant. Which would show that Mr. Halpern was treated any differently than other students who had failed to meet professionalism or academic standards.
You have a written code of professionalism?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's contained in the record. The one that was in place, first of all, let me say that there was a written code of professionalism in place throughout Mr. Halpern's entire career at the School of Medicine. The one that was in place in 2008 and 2009, and that would have been the year of his dismissal, is contained in the record at pages 149 and 50, 221 to 222, 264 to 267. And it emphasizes many of the very same concerns that caused Dr. Applegate to reach the decision that he did. Dr. Applegate in his affidavit indicated a large concern with Mr. Halpern's ability to work on a healthcare team. And the code of professional conduct that's published by the medical school as a core component of its curriculum says that understanding of and respect for the roles of other healthcare professionals and the need to collaborate with others is one of the professional standards. Also, understanding that the needs of patient are paramount and should govern a physician's actions is one of the specific standards. And Dr. Applegate's affidavit correlates Mr. Halpern's failure to show up for things, failure to attend class, failure to show up for examinations, failure to communicate properly with medical school staff. He associates those issues with difficulties working on teams and difficulties working in a healthcare settings, and makes the link to patient care. Even though some of these professional or unprofessional instances occurred outside of the classroom, the written rules of professional conduct and the written standards of professional conduct and the promotions guidelines, which govern when a student can be promoted through the medical school curriculum and ultimately graduate, both say that this is conduct occurring at any place during the curriculum, and that could be either inside or outside of the classroom. Those words are actually used, whether it's conduct inside or outside of the classroom.
So there was no substantial departure from that professional code, then the medical school would be entitled to some deference in their decision, as against the Title III, Title II.
Yes, Your Honor. That is the medical school's position, is if there's no substantial departure from its review of Mr. Halpern's student record in accordance with its own established professionalism standards, the medical school would be entitled to deference in its determination both of whether Mr. Halpern was a qualified individual and also what reasonable accommodations might potentially be appropriate. Many of the leading Supreme Court cases on that issue, as indicated in the briefs, were decided in a due process context. But we've cited cases from other circuits in which courts have conferred deference to educational institutions, even in an ADA or Rehabilitation Act context, recognizing that, of course, the court still has an obligation to ensure the enforcement of the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, as long as the school did not depart from its established standards. In other words, as long as the court is confident that the school was not acting in a biased manner and discriminating against individuals with disabilities. And in this case, frankly, I don't see any evidence of that in the record. And I believe that there is none. As long as the school is abiding by its established standards, it would be entitled to deference. And here we have shown that the school took Mr. Halpern's entire record into consideration, seriously considered his request that he be given essentially another chance, even after 4 years of his medical school career, to demonstrate that he could comply with the standards of professionalism, and determined that request for another chance would not yield additional information that would be helpful for the medical school's review. That's all, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Ms. Gustin.
I'll leave all my luggage back there this time, I guess. Dean Reifler, who was, again, the Associate Dean for Student Affairs, indicated to Dean Applegate when he was in this decision-making process that the evidence that the university had on Mr. Halpern was conflicting. That was how he put it. He did not, and he testified in his deposition that at the time he felt like Mr. Halpern was amenable to remediation. He felt like Mr. Halpern could get the treatment that he needed and be able to achieve. And that's why he thought that it was important to get an outside assessment and to be able to determine by an expert whether this was something that was possible in terms of Mr. Halpern's future conduct and his ability to rise to the level of the professionalism standard. I want to go back again and just emphasize there's been discussion about the healthcare team setting. That's one of the comments made by one of the faculty who actually supervised Mr. Halpern in his rotations in the healthcare setting, that he worked well in the healthcare team setting, that he was affable and a pleasure to have on service. The surgery department, faculty in that department, indicated that Wake Forest would likely recruit Mr. Halpern to their residency program. He was very well thought of by the people he actually worked with in the healthcare team setting. And the important thing, I think, about how he was performing during that two-year period, as well as what Dean Reifler had to say, was that the issue in this case is not whether the university can punish Mr. Halpern for past conduct, because that's really not what they've said. They've not said that this is an employment case where there's conduct, we're punishing you for it, and you're fired. They've said, we don't think, and Dean Applegate in particular said, I don't think that I can trust him to change. I don't think that he can be trusted to be professional in the future. And then what happened was Mr. Halpern said, laid out his plan, laid out his history, opened himself up honestly.
Is there anything to question Applegate's considered judgment in the sense that it was a genuine judgment that he was making on the record there?
I think the issue, Your Honor,
sounds to be a fairly reflective judgment. He considered a lot. He listened to a lot of people. He looked at the record, looked at the evidence, and ultimately made a conclusion. Whether we agree with it or not is a question probably not material.
Well,
but if it's a rational, considered judgment that is medical school based, professionally based on the professionalism standard and the duties of graduating qualified physicians, that ups the ante for you, if that's so.
Yes, the ante is high, that's true. The issue there, I think, really, and I have to say it directly, Dean Applegate's affidavit, all the things that he talked about in that affidavit were sort of, there was a stream of stereotyping running through it regarding Mr. Halpern. That,
but you keep using the word stereotype.
Yeah.
Wasn't his decision based on his past repeated behavior, not his condition?
Where I think the bias comes in is what that would mean for his future and whether Dean Applegate truly saw that there was a difference between Mr. Halpern and his medical conditions. And I think that's an important thing and gets back to sort of the point about, you know, when you see someone with a physical disability, you recognize it for what it is. A lot of times when people have invisible disabilities, they exhibit behavior or act in certain ways that is hard to distinguish from the person. And I will go back to this April 2007 incident where he was odd acting in the financial aid office. The notes about that indicate he wasn't being angry or rude. There was nothing untoward about his behavior except that he acted odd. And I think if we get to the point where we say that you can't be a doctor because you acted odd on an occasion, to me that is rife with the kinds of bias that the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act were meant to do away with. We've made progress in a lot of areas, but it seems to me that this is a very difficult area in the sense that it really requires us to take a hard look at what's being said about an individual and why it's being said. And again, I think it goes to the question of prospectively this issue about trusting Mr. Halpern to change, this issue about Dean Applegate's affidavit about his assessments that were really based in, this inherent inability to see past the distinction between the individual and the disabilities that he was displaying. So I think that's why the word stereotype is important in this case.
Where is the substantial departure from the code of professionalism?
I think, and I would say that the departure in terms of the assessment made by the university is that bias was part of that issue. And it's sort of in the employment context, you can be fired for, you know, in an at-will context for a good reason, bad reason, no reason at all. But when you stray into the area of using racial stereotypes, gender stereotypes, any kind of stereotypes in a decision-making context, that's when you've gone beyond the area that's entitled to any sort of deference, and when what our Supreme Court has said in PGA versus Martin, that the courts absolutely have not only the right but the obligation to step in and question the judgment and not rely or defer to the judgment of the entity, the accommodation making the decision. The red light is on. I don't know if you'd like me to address the Title II versus Title III issue. I'm happy to do that.
I think we're okay on that.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we'll come down and greet counsel. Short recess.
At the end.
Yeah.